Our lives are not our own. From womb to tomb, we are bound to others. Past and present. And by each crime and every kindness, we birth our future.
This is Snails and Oysters. And welcome to Snails and Oysters, the bi-weekly, bi-coastal, bi-sexual movie podcast. I'm Nat Roberts.
And I'm Allie Rogers.
And this week...
there's a game.
Yeah, well, I thought it would be... You know, Allie... Here, let's do some banter and pretend we didn't plan this. You know, Allie, I was thinking... we're into the 30s with our episodes. It's time to sort of step off the soapbox and hear from the people. You know, we've been offering our opinions long enough. So I thought I'd go back and look at some actual Letterboxd reviews for films we have covered in previous episodes. These are all real. I don't think the people were trying to be funny.
Okay.
And if they were, they failed. But I'm going to read these actual reviews and their star ratings, and I want you to guess what movie they are talking about.
Okay, cool.
And if we're really, really lucky, we'll get a weird phrase for a t-shirt out of this.
Okay, all right.
All right, first up, there's a one-star review.
Okay.
The only redeeming factor of this crude and extremely ridiculous movie is the maximum effort that was put into the costume and set design.
Okay. And this is only movies
that we have covered.
That are like, these are not the Patreon movies at all, right?
No, no Patreon movies. These are only publicly. Although if you want to hear those Patreon bonus episodes, feel free to head over to patreon.com/snailsoysters. But no, these are all publicly.
Okay, wait, read it one more time. Wait,
the only redeeming factor.
Is it Cabaret?
No, it's not Cabaret.
Okay.
It is Barbarella.
Of course. Okay, you know what's so funny is I was like instantly like thinking of Barbarella, but I was like, that review was too kind for Barbarella.
Yes. Yes. That's really funny. It is a very kind review. All right. Next up, we have a half star review.
Half star? You can go lower than a star on Letterboxd?
You can go lower than a star on Letterboxd.
Jesus.
Watch this with my son and mom, parentheses, and dogs, but you know. Disgusting and perverted. Who likes this pretentious and gross movie?
Okay. I don't know why, but I'm just thinking about Call Me By Your Name. I'm just thinking of the peach scene from Call Me By Your Name.
That is a good guess, but no, it's E Tu Mama Tambien.
Oh, that is, yeah. I mean, that's not, she said she watched it with her son and
her
mother?
Son and mom and dogs, but you know.
Yeah, I mean, that's not a movie to watch with your mom or your progeny.
Or your dogs, to be honest. All right. Speaking of Call Me By Your Name, we have another half-star review. This one says, Call Me By Your Name is so much better.
Okay. Call Me By Your Name is so much better. Is it Brokeback Mountain?
No, it was Moonlight.
Oh, that's so weird and rude.
And I can't quite tell why they like Call Me By Your Name better than Moonlight.
Ugh, God, that's so annoying. Oh, my God.
Oh, man, there were so many worse ones that I sifted through that weren't even funny, just openly racist. Ugh, here, let's hear some more positive reviews.
Yeah,
this is
a
3.5-star review.
Okay.
Oddly comforting for some reason, but also so weird. Update, I do not remember watching this.
That's really, 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 really funny. Oddly comforting and so weird. Could it be Dare?
It is Dare.
Oh, wow. I can't believe I got that one.
Oh, my God. I was ready. There was a line I didn't read, which is, I love Emmy Rossum, though. That's great that you got that on. I can't believe like, I got no that one. Hint. That's fantastic.
Yeah, way to go me.
All
because,
right.
Because, yeah, so that one is oddly comforting but weird.
It is.
Yeah.
And so weird. All right. So we're closing out strong, though. This is our only 5-star review that I included this time.
Okay.
Perfect balance of romance, mystery, thriller, and it has you on the edge of your seat the whole time. The ending leaves you wanting more.
Wait, one more time. Say it one more time. Oh,
perfect
oh.
balance of uh-huh. romance, mystery, thriller, and it has you on the edge of your seat the whole time. The ending leaves you wanting more.
Is that The Talented Mr. Ripley?
Oh, of course not. It's Deadly Illusions.
Oh, my God. You're joking, dude. I cannot believe Deadly Illusions got a 5-star review.
To be fair, I purposely picked that one because they could be describing The Talented Mr. Ripley.
You were throwing me off the trail. You were throwing me off the trail.
But you severely overestimated the taste of Letterboxd reviewers. To be clear, these are not representative. Most of the movies have pretty accurate average scores on that site.
Wow, that's a fun game. You should put some fun little game music under this segment.
Ooh, that's not a bad idea. I might just.
Yeah.
But thank you for playing this unnamed segment that if people like it, we'll bring back. So your score is 1 for 5. Though I have to say, I don't blame you because I picked some pretty non-specific reviews.
It's also brand new game. I'm just learning.
It's a brand new game, so we're both new at it. Maybe next time you pick the quotes and I'll guess them.
Oh, yeah. That's so fun.
Although I will warn you, you'll have to slog through a lot of weirdly specific negative reviews.
Oh, I love that, though. I love when someone's like, I spilled my coffee in the middle of this movie and I hate it. And I'm just like, okay, you're conflating what two different things.
Yeah, what happened to you with what you saw.
Yeah. I love that.
Oh my God, yeah. And also a lot of good movies get reviews where it's like, this is so boring.
Yeah, it's so funny because movies are just really, really specific. Like my aunt has a no bodies rule or no more than 2 bodies in a movie.
Oh, dead bodies?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So she can't watch
Think
Clue.
About how many really, really good movies that exist.
Yeah, Clue.
Yeah, listen. Everyone wants something different in their films.
You know what I want in my films? The same cast of actors playing really, really different parts in different scenes.
Throughout many centuries.
Throughout many centuries, if possible. And that's just what we have on the docket today. Because this week we are discussing Cloud Atlas, but better than that, we are discussing it with one of the smartest people I know, playwright Victoria Provost. So without further ado, let's get Victoria out. Perfect. I love that. All right. Not cutting.
Awesome.
Just going to go into the plot synopsis.
Great.
Cloud Atlas is a 2012 science fiction epic based on the novel by David Mitchell of the same title and directed by the Wachowski sisters and Tom Tykwer. It stars everyone you've ever heard of: Tom Hanks, Halle Berry, Jim Broadbent, Hugo Weaving, Jim Sturgis, Duna Bay, Ben Winshaw, James Darcy, Zhu Zun, Keith David, Susan Sarandon, Hugh Grant, David Gyasi, so many people in this movie, and they're all playing different parts.
I totally forgot about Susan Sarandon.
She's so good in this, too.
She is good. I was just going to say, I'm so overwhelmed in describing the plot of this film because it's actually 6 different plots.
Yes. Interwoven.
Unfolding. Yeah, you really got to keep your wits about you.
You really do. Honestly, I don't think that you've really seen this movie if you've only seen it once.
Yeah. You're just dipping your toe in. Okay, so you start.
Okay, sure. So the chronologically, the first timeline is in the South Pacific in 1849, when an American lawyer named Adam Ewing is returning to San Francisco to complete the purchase of some slaves. Fun.
Woof.
And ironically finds himself protecting a self-freed slave who has stowed away in his cabin named Atua. And actually, by saving Atua's life, Ewing unwittingly saves his own, because Atua later saves Ewing from the murderous con artist, Dr. Goose.
The next timeline, and one of my favorites, Edinburgh, 1936. And this follows a young composer named Robert Frobisher, Frobisher? No,
Frobisher. You got it. Don't doubt yourself.
Yeah.
And, hey, don't yes. doubt yourself. You got this.
Uh-huh. And he basically gets, I would call it an apprenticeship. Nat has written out a word I can't pronounce, but it's like an apprenticeship.
Amanuensis, yeah. Which I practiced saying before this recording.
It's an apprenticeship to a much older, kind of like extremely famous composer named Vivien Hayers.
It's all wise.
And
his name is all wise.
All wise.
Anytime you think it's an I, it's a Y.
And throughout... like the film, his relationship with his mentor goes through some ups and downs. They kind of have this rivalry, but also appreciation, jealousy. And also he's having this like unfolding love affair via letters to Rufus Sixsmith.
Who is the only character to appear in two timelines, as a much older Rufus Sixsmith appears in the next timeline, San Francisco, 1973. In that story, Sixsmith meets a journalist named Louisa Ray by chance and tips her off about a potentially deadly conspiracy behind a new nuclear fission reactor. Ray and the company's head of security, Joe Napier, gradually expose the plot behind the reactor, which is actually funded by the oil industry, who want the reactor to fail so that people will think nuclear power is dangerous. Luckily, Ray and Napier expose the plot after several key witnesses are murdered.
Yeah, that plot is really like this mystery thriller. Yes. It's like its own... aesthetic. I mean, all of them are, but this one in particular.
All of them are sort of their own genre, if you couldn't tell already.
Yeah. And the next one...
I would say is a comedy.
Yeah, a comedy. It's in 2012, and it follows this failing publisher named Timothy Cavendish, who basically...
everything's complicated.
It's complicated. He gets into this like nasty altercation with the mob and kind of begs his brother for help and then ends up being committed to an like elderly person's home. And then it becomes like an escape movie. It's really fun.
Yeah, it is very fun. And one of my favorite timelines, apart from all of them, is the next one. It's 2144 in Neo Seoul, this new hyper-metropolis that has been built in South Korea, where a fabricant or clone slave named Sonmi 451 gradually awakens to the reality of her imprisonment and escapes with the help of sex symbol and radical union leader Heju Chang. Sonmi and Chang become lovers and leaders of the resistance. Actual couple goals. And
oh my god.
They go on to publicize both Sonmi's awakening and her anti-authoritarian views.
Then we get Hawaii in 2321, 2321.
This is turning into the song from Futurama, you know, in the year 2121, 2121.
Yeah. This is the timeline that features the weirdest made up, like, dialect.
Yes, which we will get into.
If Zachary is kind of our main character. He's a goat herder in this, like, post-apocalyptic village. And he is dealing with... there's these like cannibal hunters who also live on Hawaii during this time. He is like traumatized because they killed his brother in front of him. You know, that would be traumatizing.
Yeah.
And then someone comes to Hawaii, a woman named Marinim, who's a quote unquote prescient, people who have like retained this advanced technology and he helps her access another part of the technology this one is the weirdest one. It's like they climb this mountain, then they send like an SOS out to human colonies on other planets, and then basically she helps him like restore his faith in his goddess Sonmi, because at this point in time Sonmi has morphed from like a leader of a resistance to a century later being like a symbol of an entire faith.
Like we said, this movie's complicated. I think
it's a lot.
I think that's the best plot synopsis anybody can feasibly be expected to do.
Yeah.
Cloud Atlas premiered at the 37th Toronto International Film Festival, where it immediately received polarized reviews. Some people said it was the best movie of 2012. Some people said it was the worst. It's gone on to become both a punchline and a beloved cult classic. And it deserves all of it, as you're about to hear. Yeah, it's incredible. It's indescribable. So let's describe
it. Let's describe it.
But we won't be doing it alone. Thankfully, we have the expert on Cloud Atlas. Literally wrote a thesis on this dang movie and book, Victoria Provost. Victoria, welcome to Snails and Oysters. Thank you for joining us. It's a pleasure to have you.
Thank you for having me.
Welcome, Victoria.
Now, Victoria, one of the first things, so I should say, we know each other through a mutual friend, Dakota. And one of the first things I knew about you is that you love Cloud Atlas, both the book and the movie. Do you want to tell us about, like, you know, your journey with David Mitchell's Cloud Atlas?
I would love to, yes. So I saw the film when it came out in 2012, when I was 12 years old, which is far too young, I think, to see that movie. But I saw it anyway, and I was instantly captivated by it, and I immediately, like, devoured the book, and I think it's pretty much been my favorite book since then, and, like, that really hasn't changed. And I've also seen the movie several times. The movie is, like, something that I will, like, play in the background as, like, a comfort thing. I think I could, totally, like, recite that movie backwards and forwards, as well as the book. I've read the book several times. In college, I joined the honors thesis program, which is already very difficult at NYU to get into, but I did it early because I graduated in 3 years, which was doubly difficult. And I did this for the sole purpose of taking classes and writing a full-length honors thesis on David Mitchell's Cloud Atlas. And I had to petition the head of the department to get permission to do this. And she was like, why do you want to do this? And I said, because Cloud Atlas is my favorite book. And she said, it won't be by the end of this. And turns out it still is. So,
so screw
there you go.
Her.
Yeah.
I got the chance to read Victoria's thesis, and it's phenomenal. It is, like, nice. Incredibly intricate analysis.
Oh, if you could see the faces I'm making. Thank you. it is an award-winning thesis, and I did get to meet David Mitchell and Zoom with him for 5 human minutes, which was amazing.
You didn't tell me that. That's awesome.
Yeah. He and I talked about Brooklyn Nine-Nine. He does like the show. Amy is his favorite character. it was surreal. He's a very kind man. He's very soft-spoken. And I was just kind of really starstruck.
Oh, that's fantastic.
That's awesome. That's so fucking cool.
You have some Cloud Atlas tattoos, right?
I have one Cloud Atlas tattoo. It is of the Scott Monument.
Right.
Which, if you've seen the film, you know that Robert Frobisher climbs it each morning while he is in Edinburgh.
Yeah.
Yes. It's on the back of my right arm, since the listeners can't see.
Good point.
And as far as the story of how Nat and Dakota and I know each other, I know Dakota because I moonlight as a bookseller. And Dakota came into my store and we were chatting, and Cloud Atlas turns out to be a mutual favorite book of ours. So that is how Dakota and I became friends.
And then I happened to see the movie while I was living here in LA, because my roommate, who I disliked, actually put it on because he loved it. And it was the one thing we ever agreed on, is that Cloud Atlas is a great movie. So then on a visit to New York, I was on the subway with Dakota, and it turned out Victoria was on the same train. So that's how we met.
Cute.
But I knew about you before you visited, because Dakota sent me a tweet that you wrote about Cloud Atlas. And it was like a brilliant tweet. I was like, this is inspired. And Dakota was, and I said, who is this? And Dakota said, it's my friend Nat. He's coming into New York. You'll have to meet him. And I said, yes, I have to meet this person. It was great.
Oh, I remember. It was when there was that meme going around about men's not having bed frames. And mine was like, men will have a bed frame, but it's propped up in the second half of the Pacific Journal of Adam Ewing, a dying lawyer.
He's a 10, but his bed frame is propped up by the second half of the Pacific Journal of Adam Ewing.
So, Allie, You had never seen or read anything Cloud Atlas related before, right?
Yeah, I actually, like, honestly was purposely avoiding this movie because I wanted to read the book first. But I have, like, this growing cancerous pile of books I need to read. So I hadn't gotten to it. And so because I was forced to watch it for the podcast, I watched it.
Don't think of it as cancerous. Just think of it as like a collection.
A growth opportunity.
Yeah.
A collection. Yeah. I did earlier see a tweet that was like, she's a 10, but she has such a large pile of to be read books that she's going to be buried with them like the Pharaoh. And it felt a little too accurate.
Well, then she's a 13, yeah, exactly. You know, like,
right, then she's a 13.
My Nana's house growing up. It was literally every room, floor to ceiling, stacks of books that she kept insisting she was going to read.
I love that.
Amazing. And still does, honestly. She still has those stacks of books.
Oh, she's alive, thank goodness.
Yes, yes.
A lot of time when people tell like sweet stories about their grandparents, you're like, oh no.
I didn't realize, Victoria, that you saw the movie before reading the book, which is exactly what I did. Yeah. And I feel like it's actually, I'm 50-50 on it. I think sometimes it is better to see a movie first because it helps you keep track of a book better. Do you feel like that was your experience?
In terms of Cloud Atlas, I don't think that I would have wanted to read the book so young if I hadn't seen the movie, just straight up. I do think also, though, that it sometimes can be better to see a film or screen adaptation before you read the book, because a bad book will not ruin a good film. A bad film will ruin a good book.
I tend to agree, because like the images get imprinted on your brain, you know?
Yeah.
And the converse side is that a good film can really illuminate different aspects of a book.
And I think that like this film does that really well.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it helps that the film is a little more optimistic than the book. I think it's partly a product of it being adapted by Americans. But most of the stories in the book have ambiguous endings or downer endings or you know, there's just a little less positivity at the end of each story. Not that it's not a hopeful book in the long run, I would say. It's just not as positive as the movie. And so I feel like it is a little easier to get into it, having seen the movie and fallen in love with these characters, and then go and read the book.
If I could speak to your comment that you made just now about how each chapter of the book might have an ambiguous or like less than optimistic ending. If you read my thesis,
or reread in my case.
Plug. It's a plug. It's a thesis plug.
It's entitled The Elegance of the Quiet Certainty of Baha. Each segment of the book, each of the six segments of the book doesn't quite end on like a high note or like a happy note. And none of them really resolves in the way that like a standalone novella or a short story or even like a novel might. But the brilliant thing that Mitchell does is when you put them all side by side and you read them together with each other and like seeing the notes that pop up in each one and understanding how they thread together, you do get a complete resolute story with a beginning, middle, and end that resolves all these beautiful, harmonious, dissonant chords incredibly well. And that resolution is something that I think is the thesis of Cloud Atlas, like what it has to teach us, that like even if these various chapters of our lives or even if our like individual lives don't necessarily resolve perfectly to our limited understanding, to our terrestrial understanding, as like Nietzsche might put it, as like Mitchell quotes Nietzsche so much in the book, they will resolve in the wider like celestial sense. And I think that Cloud Atlas as a novel helps us to realize that. And that's, I think, also a function of the genre of long form or encyclopedic novels, because they allow us to see a broader scope than like our minds are kind of trained or able to see in our individual lives.
Absolutely. I think beautifully put. I think that's a really good way to put it. And it reminds me of you know, a term that was floating around actually around the end of Game of Thrones, the TV series, was the idea of sociological storytelling and the idea of a story that is moved by social forces rather than individual characters. And I think Cloud Atlas in some ways taps into that as well, where it is about the scope of human history as opposed to the resolution of individual choices.
Yes.
Which also makes it pretty intimidating to start the first time. I think, Allie, what did you text me this morning?
Oh, I texted you this movie was made to embarrass me, because a notorious thing about me, Victoria, is that I'm extremely bad at remembering names and like pretty bad at remembering names in movies.
Yep.
This movie was made to embarrass me because it has so many characters and I'm never, ever going to remember all of their names.
Yeah.
It's just not going to happen. It's not happening. Not in this lifetime, not in this century.
Nope. It's like it's an ensemble of ensembles where each story has an ensemble of characters.
Yeah. It's six movies in one movie.
Yeah.
Actually, the film even takes it like an extra step further and kind of makes it like six movies like plus the sequel to one of the movies in one movie.
Mm.
Yeah.
Right, with the like frame story of the... of Tom Hanks's, I was about to say Tom Hanks's character, but one of Tom Hanks's characters, Zachary in the future, we see him as an old man telling the story at the beginning and then concluding it at the end as well.
They wanted to just wrap it like a little bit more tightly, which I respect for the film genre. Fun fact, according to the Internet Movie Database, this is one of the only films in Tom Hanks's oeuvre that he likes to rewatch.
That's interesting.
Really?
I had heard he really which is not something that Tom Hanks usually does.
Let's talk about the performances a bit, because this movie is an incredible showcase for its cast, because the Wachowskis and their co-director, Tom Tykwer, made the sort of creative choice to have the same actors play multiple roles in each of the six stories, which is sort of reflecting the book's themes and ideas, but isn't necessarily based on anything. Like it really is their decision. And so you end up having, like you said, Tom Hanks playing a villain in the story of Adam Ewing, but then playing a hero in the story of Zachary and Meronym. So it's really fun to see how broad a range each of these actors is able to accomplish.
If I could just, before we talk about the performances, add a little comment. The actors in this film and the characters, there are instances of yellow face and there are instances of white face and just characters, actors playing races that they are not a member of. And just in terms of me, like as an Asian person, the yellow face in the film, I don't think that it is a caricature of Asian people. I don't think that it is disrespectful or like done in a way that erases like Asian actors.
Mm.
And that is how I feel about like that as it relates to like myself and how I've been like, I felt uncomfortable about like the misrepresentations of Asian people in like other pieces of media.
Mm.
So that's just what I want to say about it.
Totally.
I don't necessarily feel comfortable commenting on like other instances of that in the rest of the film,
right.
But I just wanted to address it.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because it was something that I wanted to broach at a certain point and ask you, your particular feelings on. But it is complicated. I have pretty mixed feelings about it, because there is a double standard in that it is only like Asian and white characters being portrayed by people of other races.
Well, Halle Berry also does play Jocasta.
Right. She's a black actress playing a white character is what I mean.
Yeah.
But they're like, I don't know, someone from an Asian American advocacy group pointed out that there is no black face or brown face, which has a different history in the United States, and so it's completely understandable to avoid it, but yellow face also does, so there is some tension there. I obviously, as a white guy,
mm-hmm.
have no leg to stand on in making any pronouncements, but there is a bit of tension there, and I'm glad you brought it up.
I also don't know how... I think that they could have still done different things. Like, there are characters who play different genders throughout the film.
Totally.
And
which
who
is
also,
very
like,
fun. I
mean, different ages and who change their appearances completely. I don't know how they would have accomplished the same effect in the same way if they hadn't done that. And I don't know if I can say, like, whether that's, like, a good or a bad or a neutral thing. But
absolutely.
I did want to address it. And I think that's a really cool point that you brought up from the Asian American advocacy group.
Yeah, that's the thing. I fully agree. I don't know that there's another way to make this movie. At the same time, I don't know if this was the right way to make this movie. But I don't think that there is a simple resolution. So I think it's – I don't know. Allie, what do you think?
Simple resolutions in this economy?
Yeah, I definitely think – I mean, I
To be honest, like, I was just so, I'm still wrapping my head around, like, who played who. Like, I just realized when you said it that Halle Berry played Jocasta, so I'm like, damn. But I guess,
I know her makeup for that role is incredible.
Yeah, to me, it's just, like, I don't really want to weigh in on, like, the moral right or wrongness of it.
Totally.
But it seems to me that it's very obvious that they had priorities, and we can tell from, like, the casting that their priorities first were making sure that, like, these actors were in, like, most of the actors were prized roles in every time period, you know?
Totally.
And, like, then, like, making sure that actors were, I don't know, it's just, like, that was their top priority, and it seems like they were, like, less interested in what effects it had down the line, that was, like, the organizing principle. That's all I gotta say about it.
Yeah, in different contexts, different social contexts, it would have a different impact, you know? And so it's hard to really say.
Yeah.
I am tempted to argue, like, oh, well, you know, out of context, this, and this, but everything exists in its context. And so it's hard to talk about anything without sort of putting it in a larger frame of reference.
Right.
So Ali, I wonder, this is your first time watching it. Did you find it confusing or helpful that the same actors showed up in different storylines?
Oh, I mean, I thought it was a little confusing. Like, I don't think that was the confusing. There were confusing elements to the movie, but that wasn't it. Like, I feel like I really actually thought it was really cool when actors showed up in different storylines. And I think that really helped drive home the point of the film that, like, mm-hmm. what is it that Yunmi says? Like, you're not born to yourself, like, you're born to others or something. You come into this.
Oh, world. Our lives are not our own.
Right, our lives are not our own, right? And I feel like,
through each crime and every kindness, we birth our future.
Yeah. I felt like having actors in each time period really drove home that idea. So I thought it was cool.
Absolutely, I agree.
I also just want to say, I have a full PDF of the book open in front of me.
Yes, so. Love it.
We came to the right expert for this episode.
Yeah.
So let's get into some of these storylines and sort of talk about the worlds that we're seeing. It's kind of difficult to talk about them isolated. Obviously, we've done our plot synopsis, but, you know, it's interesting that in the book, each section sort of plays halfway through and then cuts off. Then the next section starts in chronological order up to Zachary's story in the distant future, which plays out in full. And then we get the second half of each story in reverse chronological order. And the film sort of dispenses with that. I could see a version of this movie that did it as sort of like nesting doll anthology films, but instead it really overlaps and weaves them together.
And I think that is to the story's benefit. Like, I think that it brings out different moments in each story that bookend with each other, perhaps a little more obviously, which I think is important for a film, and especially for, like, a film that was meant to reach a wider audience than the book, perhaps.
Absolutely.
And I think that that's one of the magical things that adaptation can do.
I agree. I actually noticed this time around something I hadn't caught before, which is there's this pre-title sequence where we get sort of teased Easter eggs of each story, just a line here, a setup there. It actually reminded me of something that the YouTuber Patrick Willems pointed out about The Matrix once, another Wachowski film, which is that the opening sequence sets up questions that we want answers to. So when exposition comes, we enjoy it. And I think that pre-title sequence really does that. But then after the title, Cloud Atlas, comes on, we get each story in chronological order. We get the first act of each story, setting up an inciting incident and a lock-in up through the first half hour of the movie. And then when we get that final sixth lock-in with Zachary's story, when he sees Marinim doing something in secret, he has a flash of his past lives. So we get each of these stories set up and then a moment that unites them all to sort of tell us how they're connected. And we, you know, it's a really interesting way to handle multiple stories from a screenwriting perspective.
Yeah. I want to read the book very badly. Cause like, I mean, I think the way that the film unfolded was really cool, but also I couldn't help but fall in love with certain time periods and kind of feel like, no, I just want to be in Sun Mi's world. You know, I just want to be...
Right, neo-soul.
Yeah, in neo-soul. Or I just want to be in Robert's world.
I did want to ask if each of us has a favorite storyline.
Ooh.
Because I think that that's really indicative of, like, who... like Sun-mi. It's like your zodiac sign, Sun Mi. Okay.
No doubt. Yeah.
I love Sun Mi. Oh, this is tough. I really like Zachary's storyline. This is really hard. This is harder than like when we play Marry, Fuck, Kill. I really like Adam Ewing's story too, actually. The character of Dr. Goose, who Tom Hanks plays, is such a good villain. And then Adam Ewing himself is such an interesting character because he's someone who sees himself as a moral person at the start and then is forced to question it.
For me, it's not even a contest. Robert Frobisher all the way.
Totally.
I love him. I love his voice and he writes his letters. I love his love story. We love a bisexual icon.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And I also think that like, especially his last letter, in the book, which is also sort of like his final monologue in the film, is like one of the best pieces of like writing in English that I've ever read. And I think it really synthesizes like that emotion that like, you know, things come to an end and maybe they don't resolve the way we want them to or resolve in a way that we understand in the course of our lives, but they will eventually. And like the hope of that. And he's also really fucking funny. Sorry, am I not supposed to curse?
No, you can curse as much as you want.
We can curse however the fuck much we want.
Yeah. Awesome.
I fully see what you mean. And Ben Whishaw's performance as Frobisher in the film is so charming. Let's get into Frobisher because he is the reason we're here. He is our bisexual icon. And he's this little imp. He really is like this really charming, mercurial will-o'-the-wisp, you know, but who I think what makes him really charming is how much passion he has for music.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also just even like the music of the film and the music as it's described in the book. I'm like, I know that like it's really difficult to describe music as it's written in a book and it's supposed to be the greatest symphony of all time. And like the music as it's written in the book, as described in the book, is not really at all musically similar to the music that we get in the film. But I think that it's just so pretty and it evokes like that sense of scope, of time, of the immense expanse, and that I think that's really cool and great.
Yeah, no, the music is beautiful, and Robert, he's so funny. I mean, I found his storyline so tragic. I mean, it is tragic. It's not even like a subjective opinion.
Yeah.
It is the trope of the gay dies in the end.
Yeah,
yeah, true.
Spoiler alert.
And it is noticeable because in the book, again, most of the storylines in the book have like darker endings that are brightened in the film, but his is the only one that ends exactly as it ended in the book, pretty much.
Yeah.
Not saying that that was a bad choice. I couldn't imagine it ending. Any other ending would feel cheap, I think. But it does sort of play into that, like, bury your gaze.
I was just so hoping that his lover would get to him in time and...
Sixsmith.
Yeah. Because in that little teaser that we get pre-title card, we see him, like, sitting in the bathtub with the Luger in his mouth. We don't actually see if he pulls the trigger or not at the start of the film.
Exactly.
But they give you a pretty bleak introduction of him.
Yeah. I mean, they tell you what's going down pretty immediately.
Yeah. And it sets up the stakes of the film very, very well in that teaser where it's like, not everybody's going to make
it. It's very Fight Club.
Yeah. That is the last reference I thought you were going to make in this moment. But I see what you mean.
It's, I feel like maybe the most tragic scene, I mean... You could argue, obviously, it's when he kills himself, but I actually think, in a way, it's when he tries to kiss Vivian.
Oh, yeah.
There's something so tragic in that because Vivian has been such a kind of domineering force in his life, and you can't help but really feel kind of resentful on Robert's behalf, you know, because here's this young man with all this talent and skill who's just being belittled in this, like, arrangement. And then when they have this connection over this piece of music and this feeling that they've somehow composed it together, even if they didn't compose it together just because they were in each other's lives, when he goes to kiss him, it's this like really beautiful moment. And the way Vivian reacts is just, it's so heartless.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He laughs at him. He literally laughs at him.
Yeah. And then threatens him, threatens to, you know, ruin his reputation.
Yeah. Blackmails him to steal his work.
Yeah. And that to me was honestly, like, I think even more tragic somehow than his suicide. I mean, I found his suicide really tragic, but there's also almost a sense of like, well, how else is he going to get out of this? You know, like, right. There is a sense in which this is the only door for him.
Right.
And in the book, he like, he's almost constantly complaining about the fact that he's like sort of trapped in this arrangement, and like, he's kind of like putting on appearances that he's like really respected in his field, but really he doesn't have anywhere to go. Like, if he didn't have the amanuensis job, he'd just be on the street.
Yeah.
I also want to say, not only is Robert our bi icon, he's also a poly icon.
True.
We love Robert Frobisher.
Yeah. That's the thing. It is funny that, like, it's the age-old problem with bisexuality on screen is, like, are you going to just talk about the fact that you're bisexual, or are you going to have multiple love interests? And Robert's solution, the solution for Robert's story, rather, is to just show him sleeping with everyone. Like, actually, one of the changes from the novel is his introductory scene is him in bed with Sixsmith, which I think is more implied in the novel than it is explicit.
Ooh.
But that could be me misremembering.
No, I think he talks about it, but because in the novel it's all his letters, it's entirely epistolary.
Right.
He's writing to Sixsmith after they parted.
Right, right.
Also in the novel, he not only develops an affair with Jocasta, but he develops this like big infatuation with Vivian Ayers' daughter, who is
right.
not a character.
Who's not
in
a
the
character
film.
In the film. Yeah. Well,
love that. Should have had her. Should have had her.
All three of them.
Everybody. That's the thing. I think that's actually pretty representative of the sort of adaptational process for this film. They didn't change the story so much as they simplified every single one of them. Like, I think Louisa Ray's story is actually a really good example, where there's this whole subplot about the White House and who's taking over the company, and it's this really complicated, like, tangle of political thrillers. And then in the movie, it really is simplified down to the oil industry is funding a faulty nuclear reactor, which is the gist in the book. The same with, like, Zachary's story, where it's like, in the book, Marinim is just sort of there as an anthropologist. There isn't really, like, there's no satellite for her to send a message on, if I recall correctly. It's just sort of like, or there is, but it's not to off-world colonies. It's just to other Prescians to see if anyone's out there. And so it's a more tangled web. There's a lot about the culture of the Valley's people and their traditions.
In the book, there's no, they get off world in the end. There's none of that in the book.
Exactly. Yeah. They just sort of stay on the islands. And it's not a downer ending, but it's not like a super like upbeat one either.
Wait, they're not like rescued in the end?
They are sort of like the cannibals attack the village in the book, and the main characters survive, but then they just go to another island. They don't go to another planet.
Got it.
So it really is just about sort of streamlining everything so that you get the most visual version of each story, so that it's not too much discussing things, talking about things. Because again, like, if this movie is confusing as it is, it would be even more confusing if they tried to pack all the information in that is in the book, just because the book has the luxury of more time.
Yeah. Like, Son Mi's storyline, your favorite, Ali, is I think maybe the most simplified one.
Yeah.
Because in the book, there's much more of like a political element, and it goes far deeper into like the world building of like this corpocracy, as they call it, which could be a whole film in and of itself, the world building that he does.
Well, that was truly, like, I couldn't help but think at some moments during her scenes that I just wanted a full movie. And I feel like I sensed that there was more there, because the language was so interesting. Like, the consumers, referring to everyone as consumers, the corpocracy, like, I was like, I could just tell there's so much meat behind this.
Yeah.
They call credit cards souls.
Love that. Love that.
They give you a soul so you can buy things.
I mean, true.
And they talk about like having to spend a minimum amount every year and things like that. And there's, you know, spoilers for the book. But there is like a plot twist in that story that the union movement is secretly being controlled by the corpocracy as a way to attract dissidents. But Sanmi still sort of guesses this, but still goes along with it because she has faith that her message is more powerful.
Hmm. And she and they're like, well, why would you allow yourself to get caught? And she's like, because now, like, my catechisms are being broadcast in every classroom and people are learning about it. And yeah, she's really playing the long game, which is what Blood Atlas is about.
Absolutely. I will say, as a lefty, I kind of prefer the movie version where the unionists really do believe in what they're saying, even if they know they're doomed as well. It's a little more romantic, I admit it. but like fucking what's his name? Jim Sturgis as Heju Chang is so like so cool. I just want him to be a good guy.
I know. He is so dreamy.
In every storyline.
Also, I'd like to say Jim Sturgis and Bae Doona, the actors, are lovers in every single storyline. Like, even in like Louis the Rays, they are the parents in Rufus Sixsmith's photo of Megan. Like, they're always together. And it's so
cute. Like a tarot card. And it's interesting how that consistency of casting doesn't necessarily play into the reincarnation subplot, because that comet birthmark is sort of used as the marker of one soul traveling through time. But each of the main cast plays that soul at one point or another. But there are still like homages to their previous roles as actors. And so it's more complicated than just this is the same character and the same actor every time. Instead, it's this sort of fluidity that I think is a real marker of this film adaptation, is the sort of transgressive nature of the casting, like we've already touched on.
It's almost like when you're watching a stage play, and if they're conscious about like how actors who play multiple roles, like how that affects like the audience's view of it.
Double casting, yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's also really interesting how the Wachowskis and their co-director did that.
Yeah, and I don't think it's coincidental that this film was directed by two trans women. I think that transgressiveness, that border crossing, really speaks to, you know, obviously I am not a trans person myself. I have a lot of trans friends, and you know, this idea that these boundaries are illusionary is a big part of the experience, that it is a construct. And it's particularly interesting that I believe this was directed after Lana had come out, but before Lily had, as trans people. So they were the Wachowski siblings at that time, not the Wachowski sisters. But obviously, I mean, you're trans your entire life. And so it has been really interesting to watch the Wachowskis films now that they're both out and see them as trans narratives or the product of trans directors, because it becomes really obvious once you know it. Like, I rewatched The Matrix recently, and there's so much emphasis on androgyny and body modification and sort of body horror as well, which is very common in trans works. And it's one of those things where it's like being in therapy, where you look back at your life and suddenly everything makes sense.
Yeah, I didn't think about it until the line you mentioned, that kind of monologue about how boundaries are just like an illusion, and
Frobisher's monologue.
Yeah, and then I thought about the Wachowskis, and I was like, that's really interesting. that's really cool, honestly.
Yeah, and a lot of the themes in each of these stories is about social boundaries. Like, we see there's, in almost every world, there's an underclass and a ruling class, where whether it's white people, white slave owners in Adam Ewing's stories and black slaves, or it's the prescience and valleysmen in the Far Future story. There's the purebloods and fabricants in Neo Soul.
But even the valleymen in the Kona, honestly, feel...
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And there's so much about like convention, like Frobisher's whole thing about like all the boundaries between noise and sound are conventions.
Totally.
And like, don't rock the boat, don't interrupt the status quo, whether that's like slavery or corpocracy or like the superiority of oil as an energy source.
Exactly. Yeah. Capitalism.
Yeah. And each of the main characters are like railing against that.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. And it's Marinim. Is it pronounced Marinim?
Yeah.
Her character kind of not wanting to breach the convention of not intervening with like the child who's going to die, because that's like not how she should behave. She doesn't want to seem like Sunmi, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. She's trying not to play God, but Zachary literally says, why is a prescient's life worth more than a valley's man?
Yeah.
Well, and that kind of plays into like another theme in the film of just the idea of that being passive is a choice, you know?
Yeah, that's a really, yeah.
Yeah, like that comes up with Adam Ewing and Atua.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Atua says, you know, if you're not going to help me, then just kill me right here. And that comes up so many times, the idea that doing nothing is actively doing something, whether you like it or not.
Yeah.
I think that this is maybe one of the worst lines, both in the movie and the book. But when Lilith Ray is like, you have to do whatever you can't not do. I'm like, wow.
Yeah, the double negative is a little corny.
Wow, David Mitchell.
I had to actually rewind at that point because I was like, wait, what? Did I like zone out for a second?
There's such that an easy read right there line. Where it's like, you have to do what you can't avoid doing or something. Like there's an easy out, but.
Well, it's funny because that like sentiment already exists in the phrase, you got to do what you got to do. But I guess that feels like a cliche phrase now. So it's like, what's another way to express that?
And she's like, it's not like she's talking to her like her kid neighbor, she's talking to like the nuclear physicist and she's like, you have to do whatever you can't not do.
I mean, I love her character and I love like her relationship with Keith David's character in that storyline, but like it's a political 70s thriller, like it's not the strongest one there, but it that's the thing, they're all strong, you know, you're picking.
It is my second favorite one,
yeah,
I would say.
Exactly. Yeah. That's the thing. It is still just so much fun. And I love the scenes with old Rufus Sixsmith, who is still played by James Darcy. It's like the old age makeup is the most questionable decision to me because it's so thick and layered in every scene.
I feel like he does such a like a cute job of playing like an old crotchety man. An old crotchety gay man, though.
Yeah, and I feel like a dummy because I'm just like, it worked for me. Makeup worked on me.
I mean, honestly, yeah, I don't really mind. Like, I honestly, there are even some effect shots in the movie that aren't quite convincing, and I don't really care because the movie sells it. You know, the movie, this is the most expensive independent film ever made. And so they were working with a budget of approximately $100 million, which is still relatively small. Like, that's half a Marvel movie. And they still accomplished something so hugely imaginative and created
and it's
six
like 3 hours
completely
long.
Convincing worlds. 3 hours long, but it doesn't feel that way. unlike The Batman, which we recently did an episode on.
If I never see that movie again, it will be too soon.
It's just such an accomplishment, though, this Cloud Atlas. Like, even with its questionable decisions or flaws, it's the fact that they nail it at all. I think David Mitchell himself said before the film was made, he thought it was impossible. And yet they did it. They made a coherent movie out of Cloud Atlas.
Yeah.
It's funny because like I feel like I've done this with other films that are like big swings and where I'm like, I have to like it a certain amount because we just can't only have Marvel movies. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yep.
But like, I am way more excited to read the book, I think, and then watch the film again.
Yeah.
Because there were elements to the film where I just felt like this is a big swing and I'm happy everyone got to do this. But like, there were elements of it that felt goofy. Like in particular, I didn't really understand Zachary's like haunting ghost friend who was like terrorizing him.
Yeah.
And I felt like
old Georgie.
Like it was goofy, but I was still like, look, everyone's having a good time. I'm glad they're getting
Hugo Weaving is chewing the scenery as the devil.
Exactly. But also I was like, it didn't quite land for me, you know?
There's also so much, there are so many like small little details in the movie that are like throwaway lines in the book, or not throwaway lines, but like single mentions in the book that are like never pop up again that the movie still addresses.
Yeah.
And I feel like I wouldn't have noticed unless I've seen the movie and read the book as many times as I have. So they really did pay a lot of attention. And I love that as a literary person.
Yeah.
And also like in the movie, there are so many ways that they bring the actors back. Like Jim Broadbent, he has like a 4-second cut where he's playing an instrument in Neo Soul in like the dingy neighborhood where they go to get Somi's collar removed, and just to goes to show that he's still a musician in the next generation.
Yeah.
And like that's the only thing that cut serves, but they still nudge that in there.
Yeah. That's really cool.
I remember you pointed that out in your thesis. Mm-hmm. And when I read that, it blew my mind because I'd still not clocked that one. Like, I was proud of myself for noticing that the hotel manager in one scene was also Una in the future scene.
Like, and then Robert Frobisher is the guy who works in the record store.
Yeah.
Yeah.
there are some really sweet callbacks in the casting, or that like Joe Napier, Keith David is the general Oppius in the future. Like, it, you do get the sense of like arcs for the actors themselves, where it's like a character more fully actualizes.
You want to hear the one that's going to blow your mind?
Yes.
Ready? So, in the Adam Ewing story, Dr. Goose cuts like a shiny blue button off of Adam Ewing.
Yes, I caught this time. First time I ever noticed it, but say it.
So then when you flash forward, you know, like 8,000 years, whatever, to Zachary's storyline, when Zachary and his brother are out in the wilderness and the Kona come find them, and Zachary is cowardly and hides, and his brother dies, and like that guilt follows Zachary like for years, he is distracted and like wasn't in the clearing when the Kona came by because he sees a little blue button on the ground, goes to pick it up, and then he wears it around his neck, and it actually that blue button, when it snaps and it like it saves him from being strangled with his own necklace, that's the same button from like 1850s Adam Ewing.
Oh my god.
That Dr. Goose stole off of Adam Ewing.
Exactly. Yeah. No, it's insane, that attention to detail. And the sort of like arc of Tom Hanks, I was just thinking of, because like he goes from Henry Goose, the worst character in the movie, like I would say by a wide margin, racist, murderous,
opportunistic. Like,
opportunistic con artist murderer. Then he's like the scuzzy hotel manager. Then he's the morally conflicted Isaac Sachs in Louisa Ray's storyline. Then he sort of relapses to Dermot Hoggins in Jim Broadbent's story. But then he ultimately becomes Zachary, who overcomes his character flaw. And so it is.
I have a hot take.
Go for it.
I don't think he should have played Isaac Sachs. I think that it like kind of disrupts how they sort of tried to market the film as like following Tom Hanks and his journey as a soul to like redemption.
Yeah.
Because I think Isaac Sachs is just a very solidly good guy.
He is a very solidly good guy.
And like Tom Hanks in the blonde wig is like, pulls me out of it a little bit. I'm like, that is a wig.
But what it does accomplish is, similar to how Jim Sturgess and Duna Bay are lovers across the universe, it does let Tom Hanks and Halle Berry have their scenes as Louisa and Isaac, and then call those back as Zachary and Meronym.
Yeah, like I don't have a better insert for Tom Hanks into Louisa Ray's story. I'm just saying, like, that's maybe the weakest casting.
fair enough. Oh man, God, this movie is so dense.
Yeah, you know?
There's just so many details. It is really sad to me sometimes that the Wachowskis aren't. Like, there is a sort of devoted fan base, and I would consider myself a member. But I think since, like, even with Cloud Atlas when it came out, it was kind of mocked. Like, it was really, like, it became sort of the butt of a lot of jokes. I remember something like Rick and Morty would make fun of Cloud Atlas.
They did. And I kind of love that they did, though.
Really?
Like, because I was like, that's Cloud Atlas. They were like they had Jerry, like they were watching interdimensional cable, and it was like an alternate universe where Jerry was playing the dude in Cloud Atlas, and he was like the true with the makeup and everything. And I was like, yes.
Yeah. It was more of an homage in that case, but it didn't really. It was very divisive at the very least when it came out.
Truth is also a recurring theme.
Yeah, actually.
Like, you know, Zachary's always saying true, and then Sammy's like, truth is singular. Its versions are mistruths, and et cetera.
Yeah, and Adam Ewing's father-in-law claims to have the truth about, you know, why white people are the dominant race. You know, like everybody is seeking a version of the truth that justifies their version of life.
Yeah.
Except for, again, these main characters sort of railing against the societies they live in.
Yeah.
Even when the society is just a nursing home.
Elder abuse, very serious issue.
Yeah. And I think that it's really beautiful how it does these economies of scale where like you have like literally this entire like corrupt corporate government versus like the thing you're railing against is like a nursing home.
But it's the same thing.
But they're both just as important. Yeah.
Yeah. That's the thing. And I think one of the reasons I would say that this You know, I always forget that the Wachowskis call their production company Anarchos Films. But I would say that Cloud Atlas kind of redeems their V for Vendetta adaptation, which sort of sanitized a lot of the leftist leanings of the original graphic novel. This movie, like, leans into the leftist themes of Cloud Atlas, where it's talking about resisting social domination. Every single story is about resisting the status quo through very effective means. Like, I would say...
It's definitely a social justice work.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, whether it's the abolitionist movement or, you know, the environmental movement or, you know, again, elder rights or
slavery
in the future.
What is Zachary's? What is he railing against?
I think it's the very literal domination of the Kona, for one thing, like the cannibalistic sort of, like, what better metaphor for capitalists than a bunch of cannibals?
If I may. I think that in Zachary's storyline, he is railing against the dying of civilization. Because sort of like, you know, in a place like not anarchy in like the political, like get rid of the government sense, but anarchy as in like there is no social structure.
Chaos.
Yeah. I think that him like sort of doing the fight or flight response and leaving his brother to die at the hands of the Kona is a very like caveman, like, you want survival at all costs response.
Social Darwinists.
Yeah, and like that's, and like him killing Marinim would have been the social Darwinist response. I think that Zachary is in an internal struggle with himself, whether he wants to have a higher mind or to devolve into sort of like a more animalistic survival tendency.
That's really interesting.
That's interesting. I would say, yeah, it is sort of a choice between mutual aid versus individual survival. And I think what any biologist will tell you is that mutual aid is the way to ensure your species continues. Because again, it gets back to that idea of our lives are not our own. We have to think about how we are affecting a larger system with every decision we make.
And I think it's really cool how Cloud Atlas speculates as to like what that status quo that should be railed against might be, you know, 600, 8,000 years into the future.
Yeah.
And especially in the book, in Zachary's chapter, it does speak a lot about, like, oh, the clock and, like, whether or not, like, how we view time and try to keep time in the future, how we keep stories in the future.
That's really cool.
And how, like, Zachary's tribe still tries to keep civilization even as it is devolving.
Yeah.
In the book, do they have that dialect that they use in the film?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Both in Zachary's section and in Sanmi's section, they have like these really interesting linguistic differences. And some of them even carry from Sanmi into Zachary's, which is what Mitchell created as opposed to like the language of the 1850s and the 1930s, which are period languages.
Yeah, the linguistic evolution is even more apparent in the book, but it is still – I really like that they kept it for the film, like that sort of dialect of the Valley's people where they say like, you know, fuck it instead of forget it. It is, again, it plays into this theme of sociological scale where it's like we see evolution, the evolution of language from Adam Ewing's very proper dialect through the sort of schwa contemporary language of Timothy Cavendish to this sort of like hyper corporate speech to a much simpler version of speech. It's really enjoyable and it really helps root you in each story. That's it. I love the little like you were talking about, Victoria, the little details, like the fact that in Sanmi's story they call them in the book they're called Disneys instead of movies.
Really, that's so funny.
Everything's branded in the book. They cut that from the movie, and I understand why. Like it's a trickier fish to fry legally.
Yes,
but in the book, every electronic device is a Sony, every movie is a Disney.
That's
I think even shoes are Nikes. Like
and like also all of like. Every instance of like light is LITE.
Simplified
little
spelling.
Things like that. Yeah,
that's so funny.
It's hard to get a hang of at first, honestly, but you get into it, and once you're into it, you start like it's that thing of like I don't know if you two have this, but if I watch too much British TV, I want to speak in a British accent. But if I read a book with somebody, like I just finished a collection of Amy Hempel stories, and she has such a unique narrative voice that then I'm thinking in that voice after I'm done reading.
Right.
So with Cloud Atlas, I wanted to write light as LITE afterwards.
Oh, no.
Yeah, luckily I didn't pick up the Valiesman speak. That would have been deeply confusing for everyone around me.
The Valiesman speak was both really fun and also it veered into goofy. I think the Valiesman was the segment that most felt goofy to me at times, and it was often the speak where I was like, wait, what? But also I liked it. I like a big swing, a big linguistic swing.
Yeah.
The Valiesman speak, I think, is easy to sort of make fun of.
Yeah.
And that's not, I think, any statement about, like, whether or not it's poorly written. It's just, like, there are so many, like, apostrophes and...
Yeah, so much abbreviation.
Yeah.
Honestly, I think it plays a little better in the film than in the book, just because you're hearing it rather than seeing it on the page.
For sure.
Because it's almost phonetic on the page. Like, there are some words where it's literally just spelling out. You have to sound it out to know what they're saying.
Well, and there's elements of it that are really, really fun to listen to and to hear.
Yeah.
Like, there were moments where I was, like, really enjoying it because it's almost, like, puzzly in a way.
It reminds me of like old Irish lilting, sort of speak. Like anytime they talk about augering, I feel like I'm in County Cork.
I'm going to Ireland next week, y'all. Sorry, that's completely unrelated.
Oh, that's awesome, though.
Nice.
I'm so jealous.
Congrats.
So I guess this is one of those movies we could talk about. We could have a whole podcast about this movie and just do every storyline on its own. But do either of you have like final thoughts that you want to share about Cloud Atlas that you feel like we really need to touch on?
No, I feel like we've covered a lot.
I feel like I've proselytized enough, so we can move on.
I tend to agree. I love this movie so much, and I love the book it's based on. It's this big, beautiful mess that I love so much, and that accomplishes so much. Even that's the thing. It is sort of a real like, you know, the idea of like, you know, reach for more, you know,
yeah,
like try to do more, because you're not going to get everything. So you might as well get as much as you can.
Right.
Yeah. So it's really just such an enjoyable, refreshing movie to watch.
Yeah.
Because of how original it is.
And because, like you said earlier, Victoria, it's six movies in one.
Yep.
Yep.
A lot of bang for your buck.
Yeah. If you don't like one of the movies, just sit through a scene and wait for the other one.
Exactly. When I was a kid, I thought that the Timothy Cavendish storyline was so boring. But I was like, you know what? It's okay.
That's funny. I think the one that was most boring to me was Adam Ewing's. I was so
really
bored.
Interesting.
I was just like, oh, he's getting poisoned and he's too dumb to notice. Like, I can't.
Well, in the book, it's so jarring because it literally like cuts off mid sentence.
Really?
And then it goes to Robert Frobisher's storyline. Yeah, you're like, what happened to him?
Yeah, that's the thing. The line in Frobisher's storyline about like a half finished book is a half finished love affair.
Half finished love affair.
Yeah, you really feel that in the book because you have gotten half his story. Oh, man. And there's actually, it's interesting that in the book there are like more textual nods of like characters reading the other stories, like Frobisher reading the diary, Cavendish reading a screenplay, Sonny watching a movie, and it is more diegetic in how they're interrupted. But I feel like that wouldn't have played as well in the movie, and so I feel like it was a good cut. But it is a fun aspect of the book that, like, part of Frobisher's storyline is trying to find the other half of this book.
And it's so literary, like, within itself. And that's something that David Mitchell does in the rest of his films. In the rest of his novels, he self-inserts characters from different novels. So there's a Mitchellverse, so if you will.
I have to say, the elements of characters finding, you know, remnants of past characters, like whether it's the letters or the diary, it's such a like artistically hopeful thing to put in a film.
Totally.
You know, to really be like, whatever you create and leave behind might find someone in this moment you know, it's really like kind of beautiful.
And like it represents how our lives still affect the future even after we are gone.
Yeah, Yeah.
And it's a celebration of different forms of storytelling in a way. Like there's the oral history that Zachary participates in. There's the epistolary novel of Robert Frobisher.
There's like the goofy diary. Drama. Yeah.
Exactly. The screenplays and the novels and plays. And it all just clearly it's one of the instances of writers talking about writing that I don't find annoying because it is so genuinely heartfelt. Mm-hmm. And it serves the larger narrative.
I do have one final thought about the Please. Six storylines, which is we've talked about how like each one is sort of like a different version of like what the status quo is, and each one is sort of a different version of like how you can each one is a different version of like writing and of representing yourself in your words and storytelling. Each storyline is also a different representation of a different type of death.
Yeah.
Which is actually something that I thought of like when little itty bitty 12-year-old Victoria was reading this book for the first time at Johns Hopkins University. And it was because like Adam Ewing is attempted to be murdered. And then Robert Frobisher kills himself. Louisa Ray is almost assassinated. Timothy Cavendish is in his old age and like is approaching just death by old age. Then Sonia is executed and Zachary's whole a chapter I think is about extinction.
Oh wow, and I think
that I don't know if that's intentional or not, but I really love how each of those segments represents that.
And Adam Ewing thinks he's dying of a disease, which is another way to die.
It
that is a really good point. That's the thing, and it's just this movie, it's so full of things like that where you can like I've often said, one of the reasons I love Robert Altman's movies is that anytime I watch it, I'm watching a different movie because I'm watching a different character or a different theme or something like that. And this is one of those movies where you can watch it every time with a different word in your head, like legacy or extinction or hope or power. And you can find just whole movements
love.
Of it. Love.
Queerness.
Queerness, gender, sexuality.
Yeah.
You know, the boundary crossing of Sonmi and Haiju having sex. She even says this is forbidden. Mm-hmm. It's so densely packed on every layer. It's like one of those wafer cookies or phyllo dough or something. Just layers upon layers upon layers. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Like an onion or an ogre.
All right. Obviously, we can't end on that note. We have to end on a game of Mary Fuck Kill.
Yay.
But also how? There's like too many characters.
I know. I know.
It's like Mary Fuck Kill, hang out with, get coffee with, ghosts. Like,
I mean, if you want to, we could play two rounds with each of the six main characters.
Okay. All right.
Allie, is that good to you?
Okay, I guess. Let's do it.
Okay. We'll do it chronologically, make it nice and easy. So the first one will be Adam Ewing, Robert Frobisher, and Louisa Ray.
Okay.
Mary Fuck Kill.
That's easy for me. Kill Adam Ewing, because I'm like, listen, you're not smart enough to realize you're being poisoned. It took you too long to help Atua. I'm going to marry Robert Frobisher because he's a babe, and I'm going to take Louisa out on like a nice date because she deserves it after that harrowing car accident.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I was like, oh, this is going to be so hard, but this is surprisingly easy. Yeah. Adam is so fucking devoted to his wife.
Yeah.
Like, he loves her. Like, he's like, I'm going to die if I have to take my wedding ring off because my arms are swelling up because I'm dying. And like he spends like his entire segment trying to get back to Tilda, and like that's his whole like reason for being. So I would marry Adam. I would fuck Robert Frobisher.
Yeah.
I feel like that's the end of that sentence.
No explanation required.
And yeah, I want to like be her bestie, like. Really? Yeah.
That's what I call a default kill, where it's like
there's just
a third one left.
Like, I feel like she'd be like a really great friend to go axe throwing with.
Yeah. I think I would marry Louisa Ray because I am a pushover and I need somebody who can get things done in my life.
Yeah.
And then I would, oh, this is hard because I love Adam Ewing, But yeah, I would probably fuck Robert Frobisher because what else? Like, I would want to be in a polycule.
I mean,
Robert
the hair.
Yeah. Like, the hair. And Rufus comes too because Rufus we love comes Rufus. Too, yes.
Totally down. And then default kill Adam Ewing. Yeah. All right. So our next three, this one's going to get wet and wild because it's Timothy Cavendish, Somni 451, and Zachary.
I'm going to kill Zachary. He annoys me.
Really?
He annoys the shit out of me. oh, but then that's left me with, I mean, I'm obviously going to marry Somni. I'm obsessed. She's an icon. She is a leader of the people. And I guess I'll take Timothy out on a date because he deserves a good time after being locked away. You know?
It's true. I think I would marry Somni too.
You gotta marry Somni.
Yeah. Just gotta support the leader of the revolution. And she's adorable. I think I would fuck Zachary. I mean, he's still Tom Hanks. You know, he can still get it. And then I would kill Timothy Cavendish by default. Plus, in the book, he's a lot more cantankerous. In the book, he's like kind of like a little bit of a racist old man, you know, not, you know, so like, yeah, he's dead.
Sexist old man, too. Yeah.
He's much nicer in the movie.
I will kill Timothy Cavendish Chalamet. I'm going to kill him. And just so we don't throw an ageism at me. Even young Timothy Cavendish.
Yeah, yeah, we see him in that flashback.
Kill.
I am the only non-ageist member of this.
Death. And then, hear me out because I have an explanation. I would fuck Somni, and Heiju can come too because Heiju is lovely.
Yes.
But because, like, I feel like I, you know, she would be very devoted and like very loving. Like, obviously, she loves very deeply. But I feel like she is dedicated to like something greater. I feel like she would not want to constrain herself to something like a marriage. Mm-hmm. Like that wouldn't be what she wanted. Like she wouldn't be happy. And then like, I wouldn't be happy. Like it just wouldn't work. So like,
all right,
yeah, fucks on me. Yeah. and then I would marry Zachary because he like, it seems like, you know, he struggles a lot. Right. But I feel like he struggles to be good. And I feel like that is really important.
Yeah.
You know, we love Tom Hanks.
We do love
and also
Hanks.
He has a herd of goats. Who doesn't love goats?
And he's very sweet with Katkin, his niece. Like he'd make a good dad.
Yeah,
and we see him as a grandfather later. Yeah.
Oh, it's so sad. In the book, Zachary, like as a younger man, like has like a kid, then like his girl miscarries, and like it's this terribly tragic
because
narrative.
Of all the radiation in their environment. It is really that is something that like it's a really good part of the novel, but it would have been tough to see in the movie.
Yeah, I'm glad.
Sorry, my roommate just walked in.
That's all good.
You're good. Perfect timing because now we smoothly transition into our very well rehearsed outro that we never edit down because we forget what to say. thank you so much for listening to Snails and Oysters, the bi-weekly, bi-coastal, bisexual movie podcast. If you like the show, please like, review. We read the reviews.
The review.
Subscribe. The review. So far, it's the one, but hey, we don't. Don't tell them that. We want to make it sound like everybody's leaving reviews and they're missing out. And if you really, really love the show, head over to patreon.com/snailsoysters where you can become a Patreon supporter for just $5 a month. And for that $5 a month, you'll get monthly bonus episodes and my film diary. Every movie I watch, I write a little blurb about it for the Patreon.
Maybe you'll get a lap dance from guest star Victoria.
Oh, damn.
I couldn't volunteer that, but hey, you're putting it out there.
Okay, wow. First
that's a stretch
goal. You have to donate like a solid 20.
That's
okay,
so
yeah, we'll
Victoria,
set up a new tier for
my
that.
Literally my heart is swelled. I'm like, wow, what is so beautiful. What a beautiful offer. Listeners, you don't even know. Thank you.
New York donors only.
yeah,
we're not traveling for this.
You can't travel for a lap dance. I mean, unless you're the receiver, I guess. But anyways, thank you to Billy Libby for our really beautiful theme music and Abby Austin for our wonderful cover art, and our social media handles are in the episode description along with their social media handles. Give them a follow, give them a like. give him a lap dance.
And of course, Snails and Oysters is at Snails Oysters on Twitter. You can shoot us a DM or add us if you disagree with one of our picks for Marry, Fuck, Kill. You feel like we missed like a really important conversation topic in the movie, or if you have suggestions for future episodes, we want to hear from you.
Well, finally, one last shout out to Victoria. And Victoria, do you have anything?
I was just about to say, you read my mind.
Do you have anything you want to plug or social media handle you want to get out there?
Somewhere we can find your thesis. You can find me on all platforms at Sprinkles, S-H-P-R-I-N-K-L-E-S. It was my middle school nickname, and I never am giving it up.
I wear many hats.
Sometimes you can find me selling books on a certain Upper West Side bookstore.
Nice.
She's also a playwright, so.
Yes.
Produced playwright.
Yes, I am the writer of two produced plays.
Yes, so I love that.
Follow me on the gram to get updates about whatever the next one is.
And we'll drop that handle in the episode description as well.
Yay. And thank you so much for having me. I actually volunteered myself because I've been a Snails and Oysters listener, and I was like, Nat.
Oh, it's time.
Nat, there's a bisexual character in Cloud Atlas.
That's the thing. I knew it was going to happen eventually. It was kismet that
yes.
A, we were going to do Cloud Atlas for sure. And B, that we had to have you on for it. What would this episode be without you?
I know. I would have listened to it. I would be like, you have to record another one.
You would have had to you would have had to leave reviews like, listen.
Listen. You missed out on the recursion.
Here's some excerpts from my thesis to help you out, but we're going to go back and redo this.
Well, and finally, we want to say thank you to our listeners. Thank you for being
a bi ally.
Ally.
Nice. There we go. We got it.